So good evening, everyone. How wonderful to see you. So far, I haven't actually been able to see you very much. As I think you have observed, Michael and I aren't taking turns every other night with our talks. We are instead going in chronological order of our hermits, the hermits we have chosen to share with you. So it's great to see you all out there in your little, I don't know how many centimeters those little hermitages are, your little rectangles, different colors, different backgrounds, lovely. So tonight I'm going to share some poems and stories with you from the beloved Japanese monk, hermit, poet, calligrapher, Ryokan Taigu. At night, deep in the mountains, I sit in zazen. The affairs of men never reach here. In the stillness, I sit on a cushion across from the empty window. The incense has been swallowed up by the endless night. Unable to sleep, I walk into the garden. Suddenly, above the highest peak, the round moon appears. One more. Today, while begging food, a sudden downpour, I waited out the storm in a small shrine, laughing. One jug for water, one bowl for rice. My life is like an old rundown hermitage. Poor, simple, quiet. And one more. In my grass hut, I wake to hear showers of hail rattling over the grove of bamboo. Ryokan lived 600 years after Kamu no Chome, whom Michael talked about last night. And Kamu no Chome lived about 600 years after Shirto, who Michael talked about the first night, who wrote the Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage that we're chanting every morning. This is a historical span and a continuity of culture that's maybe a little hard for us to grasp here on the west coast of Canada, or at least most of us are. To grasp that Kamu no Chome would have referenced the hut of Vimalakirti, the enlightened layman of the Buddha's time, and Ryokan would have known both of them, would have known Shirto's poem. He would have made his decision to become a hermit with the example of others gone before. The difference is that he was a Soto Zen monk who also knew and loved the teachings of Dogen. So that brings him a little closer to us. He lived from 1758 to 1831. At a time that was in many ways similar to medieval Japan of several hundred years before. But it was also edging toward pre-modern Japan, the Japan that would meet the rest of the world very soon. You've probably all heard of the shoguns, you know, the Tokugawa shogun. The shogunate lasted for about 300 years. And united most of Japan, which had, as Michael had said, been warring regional lords. United Japan, or much of Japan, under a central government, which gave a high degree of social stability, maintained by very, very strict rules, many kinds of rules. It was a kind of pre-modern police state, in a way. And all the daimyo, the regional lords, and their entire families and retinues had to trek every year to spend half the year in Edo, which is modern-day Tokyo, and pay their respects and their taxes to the shogun. It was a way of controlling them. So during this time, a number of things happened. The influence of the aristocracy waned. The merchant class grew and thrived. The warrior class, the samurais, became decadent, even impoverished. And the peasants suffered from heavy taxation and all the usual floods, fires, earthquakes, and epidemics. Ryokan was born Eizo Yamamoto. Ryokan was his dharma name. He was born Eizo Yamamoto in a well-to-do family in a town in the north, on the northwest coast of Japan, which is known to this day as the snow country. If you see pictures, it's just huge, huge heaps of snow in that part of Japan. It's where the snow monkeys live. Eizo's father had inherited the role of village headman, which entailed substantial administrative duties because he had to administer on behalf of the local lord all the tributes and taxes and details. But he was also a well-known haiku poet, and he was much more interested in literature than being a bureaucrat. So young Eizo received quite a good education in the Chinese classics and Japanese literature. But when he was 16, his father tried to groom him to take over as headmaster because his father wanted to retire and be a poet. But at that point, Eizo abruptly left home and became a novice monk at a nearby Zen temple. There are many, many legends about Ryokan's life. A couple of them about this time. One says that he was deeply distressed after witnessing the beheading of a criminal. We can speculate unjustly. Another story goes that he tried to mediate in a dispute between the villagers and the chief magistrate of the daimyo. And he was perhaps a little bit blunt because he ended up insulting both sides. At any rate, something in him must have said, "No, this is not the path for me. There must be another way to live in this world of pain and confusion." Maybe this was the awakening of his way-seeking mind as a young 16-year-old boy. Maybe there has been a time in your life when you said, "No, this is not the way for me. There must be another way." Maybe you weren't quite sure what that way was or would be, but you knew there must be another way. And maybe you had messengers like the Buddha's first encounters with sickness, old age, and death, or Ryokan's with capital punishment and human greed and strife. Often in our lives, there's something, some turning point, some awakening of questioning, right? So after 2 years of training as a novice, Eizo received priest ordination and the dharma name Ryokan, virtuous and tolerant. So he was 18. And then 3 years after that, he moved to another temple to practice with his teacher's teacher, a little bit farther from home. And his practice there would have consisted of the very same elements that any Soto Zen monastery today includes: zazen, temple cleaning, work outdoors in the garden or in the forest, cutting wood, cooking and serving food, listening to dharma talks, going to doksan, studying texts, chanting sutras. The one practice, and we do all those. We do all those elements in our practice when we get a chance to do it round the clock in sesshin or in practice, a residential practice period. The one practice that has not converted so well to modern Western culture is takuhatsu, which is going on begging rounds out into the community. That's not exactly how we do it in the West, is it? We solicit donations in other ways. But Ryokan was very familiar with that practice. During his time training at the Second Temple in Tsuji, his mother died, and then 3 years later, his father retired. His father finally retired and moved to Kyoto to pursue a life in literature, leaving Ryokan's younger brother to take over as village headman. At around that same time, Ryokan was reaching the point where he would have been given more responsibility in training the new young novice monks. And he would have been shuso, or head monk. But soon after he received Dharma transmission and his second Dharma name, Taigu, Great Fool, he left the temple. By then he was 33, and he spent the next 6 years wandering all over Japan, or much of Japan, begging for food, stopping here and there at temples or abandoned huts, just wandering. It was a time-honored tradition, both in China and Japan, for a young monk, after having received Dharma transmission from his teacher, to go out on pilgrimage, to travel to other temples and meet other teachers and kind of test his mettle, test his understanding and insight, the strength of his practice. But Ryokan never settled at another monastery, never really spent time with another teacher. We have some hints, perhaps, to his attitude towards monastic institutions in two passages that he wrote later. One other thing about that time, about the shogunate era, is that temples were enlisted in the shogunate bureaucracy, and every single household in a certain area had to be registered at a temple. So it was a way of temples were enlisted in surveillance in our present-day terms, keeping track of everyone. And also temples were large landowners and had indentured tenant farmers. So the temples had a lot of power, and power breeds corruption, of course. So here's what Ryokan wrote in a piece called Monks. I'll just read part of it. You shaved your heads and became monks. Now you beg your food and nourish your original aspiration. If you see yourselves in this way, how can you not realize and awaken? You who have left the household, I hear you shouting day and night. In order to satisfy your mouths and stomachs, you run around all of your lives. When I walk in the world, I see men and women performing their tasks. If they don't weave, what can we wear? If they don't farm, how can we eat? Now you call yourselves children of Shakyamuni, although you have no practice and no enlightenment. Wastefully you spend donations from your supporters without reflecting upon your three types of actions. You talk big, but your habits never change. You deceive old women in the countryside by appearing serious. You regard yourselves as able people. Ah, when will you awaken? That's pretty strong stuff. So, he must have had some pretty pithy observations of what he saw in temple life. Here's another one. This is called Discourse. Customs become diluted year after year. Both the noble and the common decline. The human mind grows fragile with time. The ancestral way becomes fainter day by day. Teachers can't see past the name of their school. Students enable their teachers' narrow-mindedness. They're glued to each other, unwilling to change. If the purpose of the Dharma were to establish schools, sages would have done so long ago. Now that people have declared their schools, whom on earth should I join? A little bit more. I'm skipping. Vulgar songs fill the days. Who will expound the luminous teaching? Ah, I, a humble one, have encountered this era. When a great house is about to crumble, a stick cannot keep it from falling. Unable to sleep on a clear night, I toss in bed, chanting this poem. This is not his typical tone. That's why I wanted to share these with you. If you're familiar with Ryokan, he's usually... it's unusual for him to go into this much detail in critique. But as you know, there have been many times in human history when people have felt like these are end times. Everything's going to hell. The great house is crumbling, and what can a little stick like me do to hold it up? Well, here we are again. And we can't set out on pilgrimage like Ryokan did, because we're being asked to shelter in place, mostly. Records are scanty about his wandering years, but we know he stayed in touch with his brother and received word of his father's death by suicide. His father threw himself into the Katsura River in Kyoto and drowned. So Ryokan traveled to Kyoto for the 49th day memorial service for his father. And then he went on and he climbed Mount Koya to the ancient Shingon Buddhist temple complex there. Some of you have been there. Some of you have been there with us on our trip to Japan. Yeah, remember? Some of you I see. Beautiful, beautiful sacred place. And Ryokan prayed there for his father and then returned home. So the home leaving and the home returning, that cycle that so many of us experience in our own lives one way or another, that cycle. He was 39 when he returned. And he settled into a thatched roofed hut on the premises of a Shingon temple. For those of you who don't know, when I say Shingon, it's actually a Vajrayana school of Buddhism that predated Zen in Japan, esoteric Buddhist sect. So he settled in a hut about 12 miles from his hometown. And the hut was called Gogoan, which translates as five-scoop hut, because the monk who had lived there before had helped to rebuild this rundown old temple and had been given an allowance of five small scoops of rice a day and lived in this little hut. Ryokan relied on support from the villagers and friends for donations of food. And although he was a hermit, he held no illusions of self-sufficiency. He was part of a culture of gift-giving and receiving. He would have known and understood deeply the words of our Zen meal chant, "May we all realize the emptiness of the three wheels, giver, receiver, and gift." He often gave away his poems in the distinctive calligraphy that became famous even in his time. Kaz Tanahashi, himself a noted calligrapher, describes Ryokan's as classically masterful and uninhibitedly playful, with exquisite use of negative space. His brush strokes are slender, yet highly spirited and amazingly powerful. So there you can Google and see examples of Ryokan's calligraphy if you wish. And they're in some of the books of his poetry. He spent many solitary hours in his hut, where he tended a little garden of vegetables and flowers, which he wrote about in his poems. But he also visited friends in the nearby villages regularly, and he enjoyed visits from those who came to see him as well. He was not an antisocial. Oh, there's one little poem, I haven't included it, where he says, "It's not that I'm antisocial, but I just really enjoy myself, my own company." Something like that. And he particularly enjoyed playing with the village children, and he wrote many haiku about that. So here are a couple. Playing ball with the village children this warm, misty spring day. No one wants it to end. Hand in hand, the children and I pick spring vegetables. What can be more wonderful? Ryokan Taigu, great fool. He's often depicted with a kind of childlike innocence, kind of a holy fool, like the Sufi Nasreddin, the Jewish Schlemiel, and Shakespeare's fool in King Lear. But he was far from naive, and he did not turn away from hardship and suffering, his own or that of others. He wrote this, I don't know about other countries, but in this country, there is a horrendous spirit called Imo, god of smallpox, who comes around every 7 years and tortures young children. This year is exceptionally disastrous. If we keep counting the number of coffins sent off for cremation, our thumbs will sprain. The few who survive are left with demon faces. Those who have children are panicked. Recently, a couple sent me an offering for the funeral I had conducted for their infant boy. I was told their next youngest had also died of the same disease the day before yesterday, so I sent them this poem. Smoke disappears into the heavenly sky. A child's image is all that remains. So there have been times of plague and times of deep mass death and grieving throughout human history, and maybe it's unusual that we in our lifetimes have been spared until now. He even wrote poems, he even took the perspective of a bereaved parent and wrote the words, imagining I am someone who has lost a child. These haiku. Seeing other people's children at play, I stand in the garden, shedding bottomless tears. And then, if I had known how sorrowful this world is, I would have become grass or a tree in a deep mountain. There are many wonderful anecdotes and legends that have been passed down about Ryokan's interactions with people of all ages and ranks. He did not go around giving Dharma talks or guest lectures. He wasn't on the lecture circuit. He expressed his Dharma through his actions, his words, his art, and often through silence. Here's one story. Once, inspired by the beautiful autumn evening, the master was strolling through a sweet potato field. A farmer, thinking he was bent on stealing the crops, surprised him and struck him with his fist. Not content with this, he then tied the master to a pine tree and continued to pummel him with blows. Begging forgiveness, the master declared, "I never intended to steal." The farmer, shocked to recognize the master's voice, promptly untied him, apologizing profusely, you can imagine. The master broke out laughing and spoke this poem. The one who beats and the one who is beaten, The one who beats and the one who is beaten recognize one another to be as ephemeral as a drop of dew or a flash of lightning across the sky. So you know those words are from the Diamond Sutra, the drop of dew and the flash of lightning across the sky. There's another one. the head of a big trading enterprise. Remember, this was when those very early Japanese big trading companies started up towards the end of the shogunate era. The head of a big trading enterprise had unsuccessfully tried to get hold of Ryokan's calligraphy. When Ryokan stopped to beg at his house, he pulled Ryokan inside. Then he asked him to do some writing on the golden screen he had prepared, saying, "I will not let you go until you finish." Left with no choice, Ryokan held his brush and wrote, "I don't want to, I don't want to, I don't want to, I don't want to," and left. When Ryokan was begging in the highway station town Tsubame, a child with a sheet of paper came to him and said, "Reverend Ryokan, please write something on this paper." Ryokan asked, "What are you going to use it for?" "I'm going to make a kite and fly it." "So please write some words to call the wind." Right away, Ryokan wrote 4 big characters, "Sky above, great wind," and gave the calligraphy to the child. I don't know if you can see this. I'm going to hold it up. There it is. Sky above, great wind. So he must have done that more than once. During this time, he remained close to his family, to his younger brother Yushi, who had, like his father, failed at being village headman, lost the position in some kind of dispute, and was ultimately more interested in poetry. And once, when Yushi's son, Umanosuke, was being a difficult young man, squandering the family's money on his own pursuits, Yushi asked Ryokan to visit and speak to him. Ryokan stayed for 3 days and said absolutely nothing to Umanosuke until the day he left, when he asked him if he could help him tie his straw sandals. So his young man bent down to tie the sandals. He felt drops splash on his neck. He looked up to see tears in Ryokan's eyes. And he realized how deeply his uncle cared for him. This hermit, this poor, ragged hermit monk, cared for him. And he actually turned around and changed his ways. Ryokan often suffered from cold, illness, hunger, especially in the long winters when the deep snow was hard to get in and out to the village. And he also felt lonely. "Lying in my freezing hut, unable to sleep, only the quiet roar of water pouring over a cliff. Winter will soon be over. Please, please come and visit my grass hut." As he grew older, it became harder and harder to make the steep climb up the mountain to Gogoan. And when he was 59, he moved downhill on the same mountain to a 2-room hut, luxury, beside a small Shinto shrine. Shinto being the pre-Buddhist indigenous spiritual practice. And Shinto and Buddhism in those days were very intermingled. You would find Shinto shrines in Buddhist temples and Buddhist images on Shinto shrine grounds. He wrote, "When young, I learned literature but was too lazy to become a scholar. Still young, I practiced Zen, but I never transmitted the Dharma. Now I live in a hermitage and guard a Shinto shrine. I feel like half a shrine keeper and half a monk." Despite his humorous modesty here, he became renowned both for his poetry and his Dharma. He had a deep appreciation of Dogen's teachings, which had only recently been rediscovered after almost 400 years of obscurity. What we think of as Dogen's masterwork, the Shobo Genzo, was lost. It was hidden in some storehouse for hundreds of years. And it had just come back into availability, and Ryokan's teacher did teach from the Shobo Genzo, and Ryokan had a copy of Dogen's Fascicle Continuous Practice in his hut. He wrote a long poem in praise of it, which I will only share a little bit of with you. On a somber spring evening around midnight, snow sludge sprinkled the bamboo in the garden. I wanted so desperately to ease my loneliness, my hand reached behind me for the words of Ehe Dogen beneath the open window at my desk. I offered incense, lit a lamp, and quietly read, "Body and mind dropping away is simply the upright truth." And then it goes on. Maybe I could scan a couple of these and add to the to your reading list. But he expressed the Dharma in other poems too. He didn't go around preaching, but there's some beautiful Dharma poems. "Before listening to the way, do not fail to wash your ears. Otherwise, it will be impossible to listen clearly. What is washing your ears? Do not hold on to your view. If you cling to it even a little bit, you will lose your way. What is similar to you, but wrong, you regard as right. What is different from you, but right, you regard as wrong. You begin with ideas of right and wrong. But the way is not so. Seeking answers with closed ears is like trying to touch the ocean bottom with a pole." Ryokan lived in his hermitage beside the shrine for a decade. And though he struggled with hunger and illness, he continued to be prolific in his poetry and calligraphy practice. But he gradually became too weak to do the strenuous chores of his daily life, gathering firewood, carrying water, going to the village for takuhatsu. So a well-to-do friend and supporter in town offered him a room in his home. But Ryokan insisted on living in an old woodshed in the back of the garden. Soon after his move, he became acquainted with a young nun named Teishin. She was a poet herself, already accomplished, and had been married to a doctor and then widowed before becoming a nun. She became his student, and they formed a close and loving bond despite the age difference. She was 29 and he was 70. I'm just thinking, rather than a spring-autumn romance, it's sort of a spring, almost winter. She visited him often, and when apart, they exchanged poems. No texting in those days. They sent short poems back and forth. One day, when Teishin came to visit, Ryokan was out, and she found a lotus blossom in a jar of water at his door. She wrote, "I got here, but no one was home. How splendid, a fragrant lotus guarding your hut." And he sent this reply, "No one here to greet you. Just think of me looking at the lotus blossom in a small jar." There's something very tender about this relationship, and there's no hint that it was exploitive in any way, from the literature. Ryokan's final illness came when he was 74, and he was lovingly cared for by his friend that he lived with, his brother Yushi and Teishin. So he had these strong relationships, ongoing relationships. After his death, Teishin compiled his poems, the poems that they had exchanged in a collection she called Dew on the Lotus. And she also published others of his poems in writing. The haiku that is said to be his death poem is, "Showing their front side, showing their back, falling maple leaves." Or in another translation, maple leaves scatter, at one moment gleaming bright, darkened at the next. So I think by now you can see that Ryokan, though in ways the quintessential hermit, who lived in a little hut for decades, was always in relationship, with the natural world around him, always in gratitude for what supported his life, the human world, the trees, the birds, the elements, a whole array of people whose lives touched his and whose lives he touched. He was a great fool with a great heart. His compassion extended even to a thief who broke into his hut and stole his zafu and zabuton. How would you feel? Ryokan just looked out the window and wrote this famous haiku, "The thief left it behind, the moon at the window." Right? When he was cold or sick or lonely, he simply wrote about it in a poem, just as it was. He didn't berate himself, saying, "Oh, I'm a terrible hermit, I shouldn't let any of this bother me." When he held the beauty of the when he beheld the beauty of the everyday world around him, he simply delighted in it and wrote a poem. And he was when he was moved by human suffering, he did not turn away. He wept. He wrote a poem. He responded with kindness. I think we could say he truly lived Shuruto's admonition. If you want to know the person in the hut, do not separate from this skin bag here and now. Since I left the household, throwing myself into the world as it is, I have erased all dates. Yesterday I lived on a green mountain. Today I play in town. More than 100 pieces patch my robe. A single bowl knows no years. Leaning on my walking stick, I sing into the clear night. Laying out on a straw mat, I sleep under the moon. Who says I don't count? This body of mind is just this. So, I hope maybe you love Ryokan as much as I do. Thanks for listening. May our intention equally extend to every being and place, with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.